This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Yik. It's our monthly mental health clinic today, together with consulting clinical psychologist Paul Jambunathan.
Hey.
And yes, good afternoon, Paul. How
good
are you today?
Afternoon. Good, thank you. Good. Right. A little bit under the weather, but just as happy as can be.
Okay. It's the mental state of mind that's important.
Absolutely.
Yes. So that's what we'll be talking about today on this show. It's the time for you to call in, WhatsApp, tweet in your concerns, your questions regarding any mental, emotional or psychosocial issues that you're facing in your life. So our lines are open, 03-7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can also reach us on Twitter at BFM Radio. So Paul, let's start with an article that you shared with me. I think it was yesterday. Time just flies by. It was interesting. It introduced a phrase that I've not seen or heard of before.
Right.
Perfectly hidden depression.
Yeah, so, do you know what the initials are?
Yeah.
PhDs.
Okay, so let's talk about PhDs
yeah,
today.
You know what else it stands for? Permanent head damage.
Ah, right. Okay. Maybe let's not go there. Let's not go there. We're talking about traits that could be present in anyone, you, me, anyone, around us. But it's introducing the idea that there are certain characteristics associated with somebody who may have perfectly hidden depression. So you want to walk us through this?
Yes. Let's first start off distinguishing between two important terms here. One is criteria, and the other one is characteristics. Now, when you make a diagnosis of any nature, when you're going to say someone's got depression or someone's got an eating disorder or someone's got perfectionistic behavior, we have certain criteria that you've got to meet, certain kinds of behavior that have to be present, and certain that they have to be absent as well. So once you meet this criteria, then you say this person has X, Y, and Z, or they suffer from a certain disease, or they have dengue, or anything like to that effect. But then we have this thing called, criteria has got a rule attached to it. You must have a certain number, certain boxes must be ticked, certain boxes cannot be ticked, and you must have them for a duration, a certain intensity and a certain duration. And if you don't fall within this definite criteria, you do not have it. You cannot use that label. However, some people say that I'm feeling down, I'm feeling low, and I've been this way for the last 6 months, et cetera, et cetera. But when you look at it on the computer and when you go and see the doctors or you see some specialists or so-called charlatans, whoever, they say, but you're not clinically depressed because you haven't met that criteria. However, there are a whole lot of people who suffer from, or not suffer, who live quite effectively from feeling down and feeling low for a long period of time, but they have characteristics of depression, but they're not clinically diagnosable. Now, this is where I'm very insistent on the fact that I don't like labels. Now, I believe that, we have this thing called a normal distribution curve. It's a kind of a distribution, people, who where the central area houses the most number of people, and we call that the norm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't like that very much because it's only stats and it's all defined by numbers and how many people you actually interview and take into account.
Mm-hmm.
I believe there are more people outside the so-called defined norm, and that's more important. People who live on the borderline, in the hazy ground area, where they don't meet the criteria for certain kinds of problems, but they've been suffering from these kind of characteristics and a collection of characteristics. So they don't meet the 4 out of 6 criteria or the 9 out of 12 criteria for minimum of 6 months, etc. But they've been down and almost dysfunctional in different respects that says, I'm not that happy after all. And with a little bit of a shove, a little bit of a challenge, with a little bit of a disappointment, a little bit longer, and you might be classifiable or diagnosable, which is not what I'm after. I'm after the fact that you suffer from this collection, this syndrome of characteristics, this syndrome of symptoms, and that's what I'm talking about. That's what the article is talking about.
Mm.
People who very cleverly, perfectly, whether deliberately or not, have hidden characteristics of depression, and they live life through that. So very important distinction between criteria and characteristics.
Okay. So do you want to share what some of these characteristics are? And after that, what I'm interested to know is, you know, does this then become another checklist that you have to tick? And if you have one, does that give you the label? You know, do we then fall back into the trap of the labels
again? It's very scary.
Yeah.
But it's important. This just checklist that this lady, she's a clinical psychologist, the one she's developed, Margaret Rutherford, it's a checklist, no doubt. However, don't forget, you are going through a lifespan. You have different challenges almost every day. Your body is aging. Your systems are aging. Well, in fact, they're deteriorating over time. And you've got diseases. You've got people growing up, people getting married, people getting born, people dying. So this checklist will evolve. No checklist should ever be static because you're evolving, you're changing. So yes, today we might have 10 questions just for you to think about. Tomorrow there might be 9, there might be 25 by the time you're getting older. So don't let anything stop you from, don't let anything define you or limit you.
Mm.
Now, one of the things that can cause people distress and cause depression or depressing type symptoms is something called perfectionistic behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we all want perfection. We desire perfection. The world around us desires perfection. They pay for it. You get upset if your kway teow or your roja is not perfect and you complain that you were cheated for a few cents. Traffic lights are not perfect. Your handphone is not perfect. Your wife, your husband, your friends are not perfect.
Well, it comes to the work context, the work that is submitted to you. For instance, by your subordinate, it's not perfect, you know.
Now, what happens there, Shawik, is that this kind of sentiment transfers not just from the adult, but to the child. And in today's world, what we see is, I'm afraid, I'm not afraid, I know it for a fact. I'm afraid that we're going to get more numbers of children who are PhDs. We have already children who are perfectly hidden depressive cases, walking around now in primary school and in secondary school because of the kind of perfectionism that's required of them. And this is driven, they're driven to this, in the car they're driven, but they're also driven to it in terms of behavior and expectations of the perfect parent, the helicopter parent, the parent who wants more A's than the neighbor's child. And so parents already demand this perfectionistic behavior from the children. The children go on to become tomorrow's parents, tomorrow's leaders. Tomorrow, they are the ones setting the culture within the family. And it insidiously gets into your culture. And now you desire to be the perfect wife, the perfect husband, the perfect partner, the perfect colleague, the perfect friend. Now, once you start chasing this perfectionistic type ideal, you will never hit 120% on all these counts, and you're going to be depressed. You're going to feel downer. You may not hit the criteria for depression, but this can drive you. What is one of the points, one of the things that you hide very clearly? The sad thing is, not many of us are aware of it. You can see it in other people and how they're driven, but not many people know and believe that they are driven towards this perfectionism and the effect it has on them and on others around them.
Okay, so that's one of the traits that Margaret Rutherford, you said,
that's right,
suggests.
In her article, yeah.
Okay, what would be some of the others?
Okay, another one is where you take on a lot of responsibility, and it's not just the silent person. It's not just the person who silently takes on responsibility and is responsible for the buck stops with me. But there are people who take on responsibility and demonstrate that, oh, I've got the world on my shoulders. I have to do it. I have to make sure that everything works. I have to be the perfect person in the place to look after, make sure everything is good. I'm the best colleague, and I will take on more and more and more to make sure that everything is done properly. Now, when you take on a lot of responsibility, that itself is a burden. I'm not suggesting you shirk.
Mm.
I'm suggesting things such as share or lead. But be careful about how perfectly you start taking on responsibility, and then that wears you down.
Mm, okay. Any others? We'll just run through them, ones you want to highlight, before we have a discussion looking at, you know, overall.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, another important aspect about people who have these high-level PhDs, this very perfectly hidden depression, are people who are unable in themselves of expressing various kinds of emotions. Now, this brings us to a very important concept. The concept is this. Do we want people to know who we really are? And yes, to a certain extent, but to what extent? And if we know, you know, we kind of blame people, we kind of suggest that you don't really know what I'm feeling. Well, how would I know if you don't tell me? How would I know if you don't express it to me? How would I know if I don't know how to read you and your language? So to the extent that we want people to know us and to feel or empathize with us, we must have that ability of that kind of language to express our inner state. Now, people who have this privately hidden, perfectly hidden depression, they sometimes, well, most of the time, they don't have the ability to express these emotions or choose not to, because that's why it's so perfectly hidden. And if they don't express it, how are we to know?
Is this a cultural issue?
Or definitely part of it, for sure. I mean, it is a learned, it's a learned trait, but it's also, well, as you get older and wiser, it's also an issue of personal development. Knowing it's necessary, practice it, learn the skill, because if you're going to be silent and unable or refuse to communicate your emotional status, you're digging a deeper hole and you're going to be invisible. Your black hole will be too deep. We can't see you.
So there are two sides of that coin. And I just want to pause here for a second. If we're talking about the inability to express, on the other side, it's the people who are receiving our signals or our messages.
That's right.
Are we open as well to accepting that people need to express their emotions?
You hit the nail, one important nail on the head there, because we don't have that culture of openness, of expression and reception here at the moment. It's coming in. We need more mental health. We need more emotional intelligence. We need this whole culture of emotional regulation, identification to be discussed openly. But yes, it's there. The need for it is coming out. The WHO has talked about it. The international bodies are talking about it. The government is still talking about it. And we're beginning to move. The inertia is terrible, but we're beginning to move. Yes, you're right, culture is an important part of it, but personal habits, the fact that we have a lot more schools and universities teaching psychology and applied psychology, people realizing we, BFM having the show regularly, talking about mental health regularly, the big companies are talking about it. Yes, it's coming in, it's here already, we just need to develop it. Mm. You're right. It takes both sides of the coin, need to make the coin.
Okay. any other traits that you think we should discuss?
Yeah, just adding on to this expression of emotion. When I say emotion, immediately what comes to mind is sadness, unhappiness. No, it's not that, you know. It's the void of inability to express even happiness or even sad or even joy. So we can't read you. So you really don't have an avenue to actually show people who you are, what you are, and that's why it becomes hidden. And your depression, of course, erodes a lot faster when you have it acting in rather than acting out. Mm-hmm. And that's what erodes terribly.
Okay, all right.
Another important thing is how you worry.
How you worry.
Okay. We all worry.
Yes.
The person who you accuse of not being worried at all does worry, but they worry in a different fashion or a different continuum scale. Mm-hmm. The person who's more liable to be depressed is someone who worries a lot and who doesn't worry effectively. So the key words here really are effective worrying. Is there such a thing, Paul? Mm-hmm. Yes, there is such a thing. Worry is a wonderful word. It's a word that actually is a motivator. Your brain and your mind basically and your thoughts are preoccupied about something for a reason. It could be a trivial reason. It could be a reason as bad as a flat tire or your house is on fire, anything. But there's a reason why you're worried. Do something about it. Pick up the phone, check it out yourself, get practical about it, because if it isn't, those thoughts will work along various axes in the body, the mind gut, the mind body, the mind big toenail, the mind ovaries, the mind hair, the mind skin. all these axes will kick in and your body will start complaining. Your sleep will start complaining. Your autoimmune system will start complaining. Mm-hmm. Everything will complain and you could die. Literally death, cellular death. So worries can kill you. True. However, if you do something practical about it, if you delegate the worries that you have, if you start getting practical about it, if you take control over your worries, specify your worries. Become particular about your worries, not letting it be global and so diffuse. I'm worried about the weather. Mm-hmm. I mean, excuse me. Are you worried about the weather in China? Mm-hmm. No, I'm worried about the weather here in KL. What can I do about it? Well, get specific, get practical, and define your worries.
Okay.
Sit down and define them.
Okay. So we've highlighted a few of these traits that were listed in the article: being highly perfectionistic, demonstrating
responsibility,
excessive sense of responsibility, the inability to express emotions, and
worrying.
Yes, of course. You've just talked about it. How you worry. So let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll look at what does it mean when we talk about these traits being present in a person.
Gotcha.
And in the context, if we're talking about a mental health, a condition that needs attention, what can we do about it if we have...
Perfect.
Yeah, if we've identified these in ourselves. Okay, so this is our mental health clinic with consultant clinical psychologist Paul Jambunathan. Please call us if you have questions for him, 03-7733-2900. WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, Ti Xiao Ik. It's our monthly mental health clinic today with consultant clinical psychologist Paul Jambunathan. If you have questions, don't forget our lines are open, 03-7733-2900. WhatsApp your thoughts or your questions at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. And this is the segment where we address your concerns, your questions, anything that you perhaps like to share around mental, emotional, and psychosocial issues in your life. So we started off talking about this term that was coined by a clinical psychologist, Margaret Rutherford, perfectly hidden depression. And so in the very name, you can tell that she's saying there are people who have, it may not be clinically diagnosed depression, but they have depression that is so well hidden, but she's suggesting that you may have personality traits that would give a hint to the fact that
you may be
you
may be on the decline towards this thing called depression.
Okay, and so what do we do with a list of traits like this? For instance, do we use it like the diagnosis criteria again? I have this tick tick tick, and therefore.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking about the earlier question that you posed, you know, saying, is this going to become another list again? Mm-hmm. You're not adding to the list of lists. Well, philosophically, if you think about it, it's our whole lives is a list.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the longer the list, the better. If I were to give you a questionnaire on depression, and if it was just one question, are you depressed? Yes or no? Now, that wouldn't stand up in court. That wouldn't stand up in terms of validity and reliability because it's one question. Then if I give you 10 questions, you say, hey, I'm so short again. No. Mine is a perfect questionnaire. I've got 230 questions. So, okay, this is clinically reliable, valid, proven around the world, et cetera, et cetera. Then I say, no, I got a better one, 1,000 questions. No, I've got a better one, a lifetime of questions. Now, which do you think is really the most reliable of the lot? A lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
Your full day up to today. If I ask you questions regularly about every aspect of today, every little bit about your existence today, that'll give me an in-depth picture of your mental status right now. So from that point of view, the longer the list, the better, which means the greater the awareness of yourself, the greater the self-awareness of what you're doing, why you're doing, when you're doing, those are all questions in themselves. So yes, it is all about lists. It's all about questioning yourself regularly. What questions do you ask? The questions are, how am I functioning? Do I like the way I'm functioning? when I compare, I suggest you never compare with other people, but when you compare about your functional behavior yesterday, today, where it's headed. Now, if you have these questions, then I think it's warranted for you to say, uh-oh, time for me to kind of change the traffic light here or change gears here. And listen, let me just think about this. So yes, it does serve a purpose. Now, I'm going to use a phrase, a word that's very dangerous. And I'd like you all to deal with this word very cautiously. The word is borderline. If you look up abnormal psychology and if you look up mental health and you see the word borderline, you'll straight away see another word that comes up attached to it called personality and disorder. That is not the borderline I'm talking about. When I talk about borderline here, I'm talking about the line that says you are now diagnosable or not. Now, I think we all generally are borderline something or other. And some of these borders are very broad borders. Some are very thin lines as well. Now, this borderline in terms of depression can change throughout the day. It can change according to your moods, the food you eat, the temperature, the weather. So many variables can change this border. So I suggest that I'm suggesting that we all are walking a thin line between feeling bad, feeling good, feeling okay, feeling not too okay, I don't care, lepa attitude. Now, being aware of this border of happiness, sadness, it doesn't trip and fall into blue to green area kind of stuff, you know. But when you transit this point, it's important for you to be aware. And some of these questions are helping you be aware. Are you taking on too much responsibility? Are you having too many ideals that are false and unnecessary? And are you expressing yourself enough? Are you aware of how you're feeling now? Yes, so these questions are necessary. And I think there are more people in town, more people now on the road listening to us, at home listening to us, who will need this series of questions far more importantly than becoming ill, dysfunctional, and then going to see a mental health expert. Do away with us. Start monitoring yourselves and use things like this to say, I don't need to go to the expert yet. I never may need to if I can check myself now.
Okay. But I have a question on that, which if you could park away, it would be then what do we do after we've had this, we constantly have this self-reflection.
Right.
We ask ourselves these questions and we find the answers that lead us to more.
Okay, I need to do something.
Know? Yeah, what do we do? But on that note of, at what point would we need to seek the advice or the guidance of a mental health expert? What our intern has been doing for the past few weeks is to go around and meet people and ask them if they have questions for a psychologist. So we have one actually that falls in line with what you just said.
So when do you actually use a psychologist? In life, there are many, many challenges, many difficulties, many obstacles, right? When do you come to a point where you realize that you can't handle a problem and then you have to seek professional help?
Good question, very nicely put. Unfortunately, the answer is going to be a little bit disturbing. Trial and error. It is good to have faith in yourself. Always good, unless you've started off your early journey with a highly eroded self-esteem bank. Mm-hmm. And the people who do that are primarily people in your primary environment, which I would suggest very, very strongly is called the absence of father and mother in today's world. Not necessarily the presence. The presence can be pretty bad too, but it can be very seriously bad. The thing is, if you start off on a negative note, your trial and your errors are going to be of a very high level of negativity because you're going to try negative aspects. But if you generally have a positive self-esteem and you have hope and you have some faith in yourself and some faith in your trials of problem solving, then what will happen is you might succeed. And if you succeed, you realize that your solutions, your problem solving behavior is effective and you build on those skills. Mm-hmm. You'll then have the confidence to build on more skills and learn new skills. So you start developing. You'll be self-sustaining. You'll be pretty resilient. What happens though is if you try and you fail to solve a problem, that's when you will need help. And that's okay. That's a fantastic place to be in to say, I don't know, help. And you'll have all kinds of people helping you, friends, social media, teachers, relatives, anybody can respond to your cry for help. And then you move on to the positive side again. You learn a new skill, you help, you solve the problem. When you start failing and there's no one to help you specifically, no one to help you sort out the clarity of the problem, the redefinition of the problem, then you'd need an expert in the area. Now, if you've got dengue fever, you'll go to the expert. If you think you have a behavioral or mood or an anxiety or psychological problem, find a mental health expert. So that's when you need a psychologist. Now you need different kinds of psychologists. So not just any doctor, you might need a blood expert, a lung expert, a bone expert. So then you'll need different kinds of psychologists. So be careful the kind of person you choose. You might need someone, you may not need direct intervention. You might talk to someone who's very good, who's qualified, a qualified counselor, a religious leader, anybody. But that's when you look for a psychologist, when you need someone who's objective, someone who's highly skilled and trained, someone who's answerable to the profession with ethics and with responsibility. That's when you look out for a mental health expert.
Okay, so you've actually answered the question that I asked you to park aside as well. So if you think you've answered it, and my question was, if you've had that constant ongoing self-reflection, what do you do with that?
Yeah, Shavik, another part to your question is what to do next after you kind of work through this list.
Mm.
You might turn around and say, basically, I kind of passed the list. I passed the exam. I don't feel bad about myself.
Right.
Everything is in moderation. Mm-hmm. Okay, good. I'm glad you feel that way. But that's self-reflection. You are not an island. So it's important for you to have friends and to have feedback. Now, that's why I brought up the issue about expressing yourself. Are you known? Now, when you have feedback from people around you, people who matter, significant others, when the other people around you start giving you feedback that, hey, you're taking on too much, la. Hey, come on, boy, you're taking this too seriously, la. You're worrying unnecessarily, la. You know, give up some stuff. You know, take it easy, time for a holiday. When you get these repeated issues coming back to you, then maybe you just got to stop and say, hold on a minute. Someone's ticking some boxes somewhere.
Mm.
Let me contemplate this. So feedback is important.
Okay. And so we've talked about somebody who's recognized, for instance, in the question that we heard just now, someone who's recognized that, you know, if I don't have the tools within myself to get past the problems in my life, when do I need to seek help? And you talked about, you know, how to find the right help as well. But on the flip side, there may be people who don't want to accept that they may need help. And we have a question here related to that.
I know a person who's got depression and who is not coping with it very well, and things are falling apart with the family. How do you actually help someone who doesn't want to be helped, who is giving a million and one excuses, especially when the relationship is turning sour?
Yeah, so where you have the support system around you,
yes,
who is trying to reach out to you, but the person in the center of it is still key. And then how do...
Nothing's happening. Nothing's moving.
Mm.
Now, this is where experience counts in a big way and tough love counts in a very, very big way. In fact, that's the bottom line. Now, the bottom line is this. Is there a threat to physical health and life? That's the bottom line. If you answer yes to that, is that threat of self-harm, danger to self, and danger to others in terms of life and death? If there is, then the only solution is to physically restrain the person, take them to a hospital, a general hospital, and get them admitted if there is that danger. Now, that is the bottom line. There are no two ways about this issue. Okay. Now that we've got that clear, that's a legal standpoint. Relatives can do that. Significant others can do that if there's a threat to self and to others. It's a legal thing. Now, moving away from that, coming to something that's more self-directed and family-driven or group-driven, is this issue of, yes, I admit there's a problem, and yes, I'd like to do something about it. Okay, that's motivated behavior. Now, the in-between is the toughest bit. You have to wait till someone hits rock bottom. Now, that is sad to say, but that's the reality of it. The way that the family and the significant others and friends can respond is to always be there. Make it known that you're available. Make it known that you're ready to help when the time is right, when they want help. Make it known that you do anything to preserve life. Make it known. Make it aware. Make it be seen that you're available. Otherwise, unfortunately, having informed the whole group of people, having made the information available visually, emotionally, physically there, having put everything in place, if nothing can be changed, you'll have to wait and wait till the sad point comes where you have to act on it immediately. So be prepared. That's the best thing to do.
Okay. We are doing our monthly mental health clinic today with consultant clinical psychologist Paul Jambunathan. If you have any questions, call us 03-7733-2900, WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We have a couple of questions on Twitter and on WhatsApp, which I will get to after the market update right here on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to the show on our Health and Living segment today, our mental health clinic with consultant clinical psychologist Paul Jambunathan, where we are taking your questions or anything you'd like to share about your mental, emotional or psychosocial issues. We have Othman on the line. Good afternoon, Othman.
Yes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'm Othman. This is the third time. I wish to speak to Dr. Paul.
Hey, Othman, Paul here.
Hey, you remember me?
I remember you well, old buddy.
I'm okay now. No, because you're bringing a subject called PhD, permanently hidden depression.
Right.
I have a simple solution because my case is almost cannot be cured because this is glaucoma blind. Is it?
Yes, yes.
So I'm thinking when I heard about you, I remember a poet called Doctor. I've forgotten. He said, "Hope spring eternal in the human breast." It means you have only hoped. You know what I'm trying to say. Every time after my prayer, I said, I give all my hope to him, capital H-I-M. I said, if it happened, it happened. That's all. Because I don't wish to move forward further because it is not recoverable anymore.
Right.
So that's all I'm thinking about, you know. Alexander Pope, you know.
Uh-huh.
I think you've heard of him.
Yes, hope yes, yes.
In eternal, in the human breast.
Yeah.
Okay, I closed.
Oh, thanks, Othman.
Thank you very much for sharing, Othman. So
he's got a very good point there. Mm-hmm. He's irreversible damage to his neural system and his vision. Mm-hmm. He's accepting of the fact that he must have gone through a lot of grief when this process was unfolding. But acceptance of the fact, finally, he's been blind for many years. Mm. He's one of our regular listeners, a very, very nice chap who contributes very, very well. He went through all the problems of accepting his situation and he's very productive in his mind now. Fantastic. Mm.
But that idea of hope, that word, which can sometimes be used in a very glib manner by somebody who doesn't understand depressive symptoms or major depression, you know?
Oh, no, there's no such thing as hope.
Thank you. You
know, no, when you're in that state, you don't... You see, what happens in that state, if you're on the decline and you're getting depressed regularly... Academically, you know things may change. You might be aware of that. But while you're on the downslide, we develop a situation where you have hopelessness and helplessness. That's when things become very scary and suicidal. That's when suicidal ideation begins to take effect and begins to form. So, yeah. So the word hope is a big thing there later on.
Okay. We have a question from Rose on WhatsApp about that idea of borderline depression. Mm. And her concern is how to recognize that she may be on the border, that it might happen again where she crosses that line.
Okay.
How can she recognize that it's becoming too overwhelming?
Okay. Now, please remember, I just want to remind everyone, there's no line to cross. Okay? You're not going to wake up one morning and say, tomorrow I'm going to be depressed or I suddenly lose my depression. It doesn't happen in either direction. Okay? This is a gradual process that slowly begins to overwhelm you and you will slowly become more and more dysfunctional and more unhappy with yourself and with the world around you. Now, it's a gradual scale. So don't go to bed tonight thinking you're going to wake up clinically depressed tomorrow. If you are getting depressed, you're on that journey. If you're not getting depressed and you're surviving and you're effectively living every day, then you're doing a very good job of it. Okay. So when do you think you're approaching that borderline or the customs or immigration of depression? Well, the fact that you're talking about it is the best signal. The fact that you're wondering about yourself, you're spending time thinking about your function, you're thinking about yourself and how you are feeling. Those are the important issues. We don't do that enough during the day. We're so busy, busy, busy doing so many other things. We don't stop and reflect on ourselves at the end of the day, during the day, the beginning of the day. We need time for ourselves. Very important time. The most important time, perhaps. The fact that you're doing that is when you're already, every day, you're checking yourself out. You've got your finger on your emotional pulse, on your emotional intelligence pulse, your bank of surviving and skills. Well done. That's the way to do it.
So by being aware constantly, you would know when something is
and you've got to be
sliding
honest with
down the gradient.
Yes, you've got to be honest with yourself and say, yes, maybe. Mm. Now, you know, you don't have to wait to see a psychologist or an expert. Make an appointment. Go and chat with someone. Buy them the most expensive cup of tea. You know, pay their bills. But don't wait for the car to break down. Send it for servicing regularly. Just go and minor checkup. Just have a good chat. Just say, I want 1 hour with you. You know, ask me some general questions. Just tell me whether I'm okay or not. What do you think? You know, da-da-da-da-da. So, yeah, don't wait to be sick. Take those vitamins now.
But I, on that note, Shan is asking on WhatsApp. A friend of his was open to seeking help, but unfortunately met two psychologists where things didn't go so well and created a negative perception that these professionals can't help his friend. So, Shan wants to know, how can I help as a friend, and what are the ways to find a suitable mental health professional?
we've got several talking points here. The first thing is, whatever you do, if you're going to look for, I can only speak about my profession. Whatever you do, if you're going to look for someone in my profession and professional background, contact the professional bodies. Now, we clinical psychologists don't have a professional body yet. We've got a society. And we have people who are vetted into that society. So you can write to the society and find out whether this person is registered with or without them, and with them or not. Because, well, you don't have to be registered with them. But it's some recognition of the other psychologists in Malaysia and whether you're recognized. Look them up. Check out their credentials. Do your homework. Whatever you do, whenever you're going to see a doctor or a specialist, or even you're going to buy food from a bakery, you'll check the bakery out first, man. It's crucial.
So what's the name of the society?
Malaysian Society for Clinical Psychologists.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Now, please check us out. Check all the psychologists out. Do your homework. Take your time. Now, it's another thing, another point that you brought up. Hey, the issue of match is important. I've had thousands of clients over my many years of working. And not every client and I see eye to eye because the personality doesn't match, the style doesn't match. I might be the best, they might be the best person who's ready for, who's motivated to change. But the match must be there. And so if it doesn't match the first time, don't worry about it. Take your time. Find someone that you can communicate with. Even the slightest bit of communication, if there's a click, change can happen. So don't be worried that two people are giving you a negative impression. Sometimes it works best the first time round, sometimes the third time round. But be patient about it. If there is an emergency, however, don't wait. Act quickly.
Okay. And Maven on Twitter is asking, and this is interesting, it's looking at children now. Is there any way to control the use of social media among children? Do you think it could cause depression in children?
Oh, yes. Answer is yes. I mean, anything, any toy, any instrument, anything that's overused, underused, wrongly used, any device can cause depression. It can cause a lot of joy too. It's how it's used and why it's used, the intensity of usage, and how do you want to regulate children using that? Well, I don't know how it was regulated in my time because we didn't have any. Now I use it. I can live without it. My children, they use it more than I do, far, far more than I do. And they do other things too. So I think it's the fine balance of when and how you use these devices and who they role model. Aha, that's an important thing. Who they role model, the kind of alternative behavior that society provides them around the devices that they have and hold. That's important too. So set an example. That's one way.
Okay. Well, we have to wrap up the show now. But do you have some final thoughts you'd like to leave with us, Paul, especially if we want to cycle back to what we started this hour with, the perfectly hidden depression, you know? And what would you like to leave us with?
Well, we didn't finish the checklist. We don't have to finish the checklist because there's no per se checklist per se. But her name is Margaret Rutherford. Okay, and the topic was PhD, perfectly hidden depression. Look it up. The fact that you're going to look it up means you are motivated already to make sure that you are on solid ground, semi-solid ground, and then there's no quicksand undermining your stand. That's an important thing. I suppose what we can derive from today is spending time with yourself, being aware that whether you are aware of what's happening to you, the kinds of things that are pressure points for you that you may not be aware of, the kind of work you're taking on, the kind of responsibility you're taking on, and the various kinds of emotional cancers that are around. You know, yeah, that's a new word that I've coined just now. Emotional cancers, various emotions that eat away at you, which you don't realize have got greater telling negative effects rather than positive healing effects. Identify those things. Identify those variables, the people who walk around you with that kind of negativity. Yes, being grateful is important. Gratefulness is great. Gratitude is a great thing. But along with that, you've got to have sugar and salt together to bring out taste. So it's okay if you're sometimes angry about things. It's okay if you're sad about things. It's okay to be negative about things. Please don't go around telling yourself, I'm bad, I'm negative, because I've got more emotional energy than positive. I've got to be filled with positive psychology. Too much positive psychology can also be bad for you if you don't have buoyancy in your emotions, if you don't have balance throughout the day. At the end of the day, when you're lying in bed, you should be a little bit more positive than negative. It's good for your body and for your brain to rest. So try and audit your day regularly, a regular audit where you are checking, balancing yourself. You've got the pros and cons. I'm aware of what's going on. I like it. Today's a good day. It's looking better. Tomorrow might be even better. Have I got the skills? What can I do about the skills? But asking yourself, spending these questions, spending time with yourself, that's the way to go.
Okay. Thank you very much, Paul. That was Paul Jambunathan, consultant clinical psychologist, in to talk to us on our monthly mental health clinic. He'll be back again next month. You've been listening to Health and Living on A Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.